The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Books Podcast with me, Richard Lee.
And me, Sian Kane.
This week we talked to the writer Ben Aronovich about his latest book in the best-selling Rivers of London series. Later in the show we'll be talking about the long-awaited third instalment in Hilary Mantel's Cromwell trilogy, The Mirror and the Light. Ben Aronovich began his career in screenwriting, writing for TV juggernauts like Casualty and Doctor Who. His fiction is cut from something of the same cloth, with his best-selling Rivers of London series following the adventures of a young officer in the Metropolitan Police who meets a ghost and winds up working for The Folly, a secret branch of the Met that handles the supernatural. When he came to the studio to talk to Sian about the eighth book in the series, False Value, she began by asking him about London and the vital role the city plays in his fiction.
I'm a Londoner.
Yeah.
And so therefore my relationship with London is that I'm a Londoner. That's my relationship with London. And if you're a Londoner, London, you have a different relationship with London than people who have come into London. People who come into London for whatever reason, like yourself, have come in for excitement or work or desperation, or that London is a kind of a screen upon which they project their fears and their hopes. And but if you're a Londoner, it's where you went to school.
Mm.
It's where you went to cinema, your first nursery, your first film. I mean, I remember going to see Robin Hood, the Disney Robin Hood down. That was like my first West End, proper West End film. Went going down with my parents, and there were buskers and all that kind of stuff is basically kind of like you, for a Londoner, London is their small town.
Mm.
It's just a very big small town.
Rivers of London was a massive bestseller. I mean, it sold really well all over the world. Now we're on book eight of these series, and they follow Peter Grant, who is seconded to the last officially sanctioned English wizard, who's working for the Metropolitan Police, Thomas Nightingale, who is one of my favourite book characters. and they're so fun. And I was wondering about how you came up with this.
There's a flippant answer to that. I was desperate. I needed money. I was going bankrupt. And I was working at Waterstones, running the crime and the science fiction section. So I used to make this joke, which no one gets anymore, which is, why take two genres into the shower, you see? But you have to be over 40 to find that funny. But somebody's laughing, I guarantee, listening to this has found that funny, at least
yeah.
One person. I was looking around in ideas that I had rummaging around in my head for various story ideas, and one popped out, and it was called Magic Cops. And it was a television idea I had, which was basically, what it says on the tin. It was going to be
magic cops
that did magic. And I quite like the idea of kind of working class magic, the idea of people who kind of turn up and go, oh God, not enough of Balrog, kind of. And I always thought of it as what happens if Gandalf joins the Sweeney, you see?
That was just really jaded.
Well, just like it's a day of work. It's
and then...
I started adapting it because prose is a different medium from television.
Mm. Yeah, you were writing for Doctor Who.
Back in the day, but before it was fashionable. And I kind of adapted it, and then just one day Peter Grant walked into my head, and I wrote the first five pages. And I just knew that I had something hot, and it was just a question of sitting down and then writing the full 96,000 words.
Yeah.
And then I would be able to, I knew I was going to be able to sell it to an agent and a publisher. I didn't know it was going to be so successful. I thought it was going to be, a good solid mid-list fantasy book. That's what I thought.
Yeah. I was thinking that, I think there's a good measure for fantasy novelists when, you've sort of, inverted commas, made it. When someone online has made a wiki website for your books, and there's now the Follypedia, which is...
Yes, but you do know there's a Jane Austenpedia as well.
Yeah, she's pretty famous too, She kind of made it.
It's not just fantasy writing.
No. No, but I think, when you've got fans who are willing to sort of extensively map and document the histories of characters and stuff like that.
Well, the thing we found about the books is they don't sell to the audience we thought they were going to sell. So we thought it was going to sell exclusively to that audience. But it's a very general audience that spread. When I go on tour, I'm meeting people from all over.
Are you surprised by, people like myself who may have never been to London or not from the UK who love these books and love the setting so much.
Well, given that even Scottish people like them,
they must be all right.
They must have a wider appeal, given that, you know, London is the great Satan in the cosmology of Scotland. So, not really. I like books about foreign places. Mm. So I completely understand. There's nothing quite like getting a good crime story set in a foreign country because you think you're learning something and there's a horrible murder. You know, what could be better?
And I was wondering how you go about building a world like this when, just by the very nature of fantasy, you kind of have access to all the toys you could possibly want, that you are setting your own limitations about, you know, what is logical and what isn't in your own universe.
Well, I mean, part of it is like I have my personal preference for what I think I want in my fantasy world. So that creates a kind of one level of restriction. So, you know, I like certain things. So you're going to get those things. Yeah, I like maps. I like logical, magical systems, but I also like whimsy.
Mm.
So I wanted a system, basically a sort of background where I could have both.
Yeah.
So whereas the kind of magic that Peter and Nightingale do is very formalistic. I mean, codified by an Isaac Newton. So, you know, it's that kind of a magic where it's like lots of rules and stuff like that, and there are the limit, you know, I have very strict limitations. We actually follow the law of thermodynamics, so you can't create things out of nothing. You can't abolish things because of the energy constraints. And then I have my rivers and my fae who could do extraordinary things out of whimsy, so that I can have a bit of sort of stardust magic, sort of like pixie dust magic that can be sprinkled over things. And so I basically just aim to have my cake and eat it.
Yeah.
That's what I have. So I can have both. I go, what do I want? And then I just strive towards making it. I make quite a lot of it up as I go along.
Really?
As needed. When I finish the story. The story is the most important thing.
Mm.
You then build the story and you build the kind of world around the story.
I mean, well, you mentioned people working in a world that isn't ours, and this London is very recognisable, I think, for either people living in this moment right now, but also people living in the UK or even really any major city. Could you just sort of talk a bit about some of the topics you're talking about in this eighth instalment, just because particularly the Terence Skinner, our Silicon Valley tech bro, who's our sort of our big villain. Can you talk a little bit?
I'm not sure he's the villain.
I don't want to spoil anything for anyone.
I didn't think of him as the villain. Misunderstood, Terence Skinner. I don't really think of like in terms of issues. I just think, oh, I need this story, often the stories start with either a story idea, or they start with an area that I want to look at, or they start with just a vague scene that I want to put in.
Really?
Yeah, I started books, or I have a title.
Mm-hmm.
The second book is called Moon Over Soho, and I just had the title.
Mm.
I had no idea why I was in Soho, and then I thought, well, it's got to do with jazz. You see, and then you build up. So Moon Over Soho is a good example. I had the title, which comes from the Threepenny Opera. It's one of the tracks of the Threepenny Opera.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, okay, it's in Soho, and I don't want to do werewolves, so what else happens in Soho? And I thought, jazz happens in Soho. And of course I had Peter's dad's background.
Mm.
So I thought, right, this is my chance to look at Peter's dad's background and his relationship with his father, and with jazz. I wanted to do a story where you have a murder in the most expensive bit of real estate in London. And that was the Hanging Tree, because you start in number 1 Hyde Park, which is the most pointless piece of architecture has ever been built in this country whatsoever.
There's other authors that have used, I'm thinking like particularly perhaps, there's China Mayville, and there's also Neil Gaiman, who have used London as a setting for, of London equivalents, like settings for fantasy books. Reading this book, I was thinking about Neverwhere a little bit, just because of that, the way he uses location and then embodies them in a person. So like that Angel Islington, for example, in Neverwhere. I read an interview with him, and he was saying that it actually, the sequel was born of anger in terms of how certain things that had changed about London since he wrote Neverwhere. And do you feel angry at all about some things and how they operate in London? Yeah. Like, does it feed into your writing?
My anger is more I don't know. London is a huge city. It's always been a bit of a mess. Mm. It's never been a coherent city. And Londoners have never allowed the establishment to really get control. I think we were really at the point where, I think a couple of points in the 19th century and now we're at the point where the gentry have made a concerted effort to seize control of London and take it away from the people that live there. But it never really lasts for long, and I feel we'll have some more riots and drive them out sooner or later.
Really?
You can see that from the concerted waves of efforts to try and drive the working class out of London. You've got things like, for example, Charing Cross Road was built to demolish St Giles Rookery. These people were not rehoused. Nor were the people who were driven out by the building of the Metropolitan Line. None of these people were ever compensated or rehoused. They were just driven out. And then we got slightly more humane in the 1920s and 30s and 40s when we started shifting people out of London into the new towns and stuff like that. And the bedroom tax is a particularly mean-spirited drive to drive poor Londoners out of London. And I don't think anyone's kind of thinking to themselves and rubbing their hands in a kind of Victorian villain's glee going, aha, we shall drive the poor out of London. But, you know, they don't care.
Yeah.
And what the problem for London is that the rest of the country is, London is used as a scapegoat for the rest of the country. So you go around the rest of the country and go, oh, London, London, London. But actually, the establishment doesn't care about London. It always makes you got a little taste of that when Extinction Rebellion tried to do a thing on the train.
Yes.
When they tried to superglue themselves to a commuter train.
Yes.
As if the people on the commuter train were the people who were getting in the way of environmental change.
And also using public transport, which is surely something everyone should be encouraged to do.
I mean, if you're listening to me, Extinction Rebellion, go out to those villages around London where all the rich and influential people live and superglue yourself to the SUVs. That would be a much more appropriate.
I mean, with things like this, say, like, Extinction Rebellion or things like Brexit, you know, do you ever consider putting these problems that are very much in our minds, in our London, in your fiction?
No, I don't do what's known as fantastic racism or what I was not going to do is like do this refugee stories by focusing on elves or something who've been thrown out of fairyland. If I do those stories, I will do them by having refugees from Syria if I was to do that. But I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't sit down and aim to do it. I don't think it's my place to do that.
Right.
I think there are plenty of people with their own stories who actually have lived those experiences who should be given space to express them. I don't think it's my place to write into the experience. To reflect it, yes, because it is part of London.
Mm.
So to reflect it in the same way I reflect the other parts of London, other good and bad bits of London, and to reflect the experiences of the mad diversity of the city.
Yes.
But I don't think it's my place to be going, oh, look, I shall make it so that magic becomes, I don't know, an analogy for drug addiction or something.
What you were saying about reflecting the diversity of London, that's one of the wonderful things. So one of many wonderful things about these books is that how very true to form, when I did finally arrive in London, the London I saw on the page is very much one that I could recognize. And particularly with Peter, and Peter is mixed race, he's working class, and his mother's, she's from Sierra Leone.
Yes.
Yeah. And you have said quite a lot about this before, but, you know, talking about how, say, like, US publishers have handled Peter in terms of how his...
Well, finally, it's the covers.
It's visual representation.
They well, isn't so much whitewashing, just bugger it up.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things. I know what happened. I found out what happened. It's basically, in publishing, especially when you're a first author, there's a limited budget for the cover.
Mm.
So what happened was they went out to find a mixed race actor to shoot a picture of holding a gun because they're Americans and you can't have a thriller cover without someone holding a gun. And they went and got someone who because he's not a villain, there's only two main, two main black stereotypes in America who aren't villains, and that's the big hulking guy who's on your side, and the skinny chattermouth
who's
on your side. And they went out and got a big hulking guy with no neck, and they shot him, and then it just looked really stupid.
It didn't look like
Peter. And then that was, and then just to compound it, they decided to black out him completely, which just was just. I don't even know why they did that. And there was no more money for another cover.
Mm.
So I just said, that's terrible cover. But there's nothing you can do when you're first starting out as an author. You don't get any say, in, especially in America, if you're a British author, in what the covers look like.
You've been admirably vocal about publishing and how publishing handles diversity and
badly,
particularly I'm thinking back...
And the media in general. As a Londoner, right... It's very striking when you go into these national institutions like publishing and the BBC and the media and the press, right? You go in and how white they are compared to London.
Yeah.
Because you go to a mixed school, you go live in a mixed area, you have lots of mixed friends, and you go into these, suddenly you walk into the BBC, and the only black people, this is 1988 when I first walked into the BBC, it might have changed a bit, the only black people are the people working in the canteen and on the door. And literally, that is what you do. And in publishing, it's the same. It's all people from Hastings and, I don't know, places outside the M25. And they're lovely people, but they're not the most diverse group.
No. Do you think there's anything, I mean, there's sometimes a lot of publishers have started bringing in things like sensitivity readers and stuff like that. I mean, how do you feel about those sorts of things? Do you think
I think they're going to have to throw stuff at a wall until some of it works, basically. Yeah. Sensitivity readers, I think they should be offered to authors.
Yeah.
If you want them. I think there's nothing, does never hurts if you're doing a subject that you're not actually intimately acquainted with yourself, to have someone who is read it for you. What you don't want is a kind of checklist.
Mm.
Because that doesn't matter. And the thing is we can deal with this problem very simply. We just have more non-white people writing books, and then we don't have to worry about this.
Well, that's what again. I always feel about sensitivity readers. It's like, why don't you hire those people to work at the publisher all the time?
Yeah.
I mean, this is very tangentially involved, but I found it interesting. It took me a very long time to realize that your brother is David Aranovich.
Really?
Even though you got the same last name and you don't look too dissimilar.
Yeah, yes. Most people think I'm him half the time. Still gets tweets from people congratulating one of the books that he's writing. Yeah. So.
I mean, I was reading an interview with him about Party Animals, which is a sort of book about your family.
Yes,
right?
Lovely book.
Yeah. Well, I read this interview with him, and he was saying that he had not shown you the book, and it was sort of at the you know, he's doing interviews for it, so it was quite a late stage. I mean, he said, you can interpret it quite aggressively, which is that this is my attempt to take their parents away from my siblings. But I didn't want to invite a problem that didn't exist. And I thought that was really interesting in a family where you'd have multiple authors about whether they're, you know, what is the line between you as an author and as a brother?
This is a non-fiction thing, right?
Yeah.
This idea that he could take my parents away from me by writing a book about it. What?
Is this a pretension of non-fiction writing?
Yeah, this is like, he can't take my parents away. I mean, I just don't even understand the concept of what, you know, it's a very Sunday supplement thing. It's kind of like, yeah, I feel like my parents were taken away by this statement. No, I was great because I only appear in it as a 2-year-old.
Mm.
So I come up completely unscathed personally, right? But it was fascinating. It was about all the background stuff about my father that I didn't know and about my mother. I mean, I knew some of it, but I missed a lot of the relatives. I missed a lot of the very intense party stuff because by the time I was around, it wasn't so much they were drifting away from the party, but the party was mellowing out.
The party we're talking about is the Communist Party.
Yes. When you're from a family like mine, there is only the party.
The party.
Right? And people are either in the party or they're not in the party.
Oh, that's so interesting then, because I was wondering whether there were any lines between how, say, Ben, the author, would react to a book about his own family, or Ben, the brother, because he seemed a little bit worried at that point.
Well, because he got a lot of stick from my mum's friends and my dad's friends. They got a lot of stick. It's a bit like religion. They, you know, my mum had communism the same way other people have religion. It was a set of rules. You did this was bad, that was good. You know, good people did this, good people believed that, bad people believed this. My mum was very, very forthright about the use of violence to overthrow capitalism. She was very disappointed, I think, in the Communist Party when it drifted into kind of political...
The gentler end.
The gentler end. I don't know. Sometimes, you see, it was very hard to tell with my mum. Mm. To her dying day, she claimed not to know the meaning of the word sarcasm. But we think she might have been sarcastic when she was saying it. But we never caught her out.
So I have to then ask, I mean, now we're at the, you know, we've got book eight now. Where do you go from here in terms of PJ? I mean, like, I don't want to spoil it in terms of where it's all left off. And there's a lot for, you know, it's an open end. You know, we're definitely getting a book nine, I'm guessing.
And
you're going to go up for 10
or 12?
Contracted.
Yes.
So do you have your, you were mentioning that you go from title first to perhaps.
Sometimes an idea. Sometimes an idea.
Well, I was actually wondering about locations. Where else in London? And
the next one I was going to do was going to be Golders Green and Canals. I don't know why, but for some reason it's veered off, at least part of it has veered off to Manchester, which caught me by surprise. Yeah, so I went, oh, okay. But probably 70s Manchester, so I'm not sure I'll have to do that much research because Manchester's changed quite a bit. And the next one after that is Aberdeen.
Possibly the most exciting news of my year is that you are adapting Rivers of London with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg. And when I found out about that, I was like, yes, they're sufficiently nerdy enough to do a good job.
Oh, very, very nerdy. Yeah. I mean, it was like a warm bath. I just go, like, after dealing with other television companies and they don't really understand what you're talking about, I just sat down with Nick Frost and we just nerded out for about 15 minutes. Yeah, they're mad. They've hired equally mad people, so I fit in.
You're pretty excited.
Perfectly well, yes. Nerdy mad people. Basically. It's going to be very expensive. It's going to be very difficult to finance. So it's still uncertain as to whether it will actually happen, but we're going to give it a good shot.
That was Ben Aronovich. False Value is published by Gallants. After the break, we'll be heading back to the 16th century and the woman of the moment, Hilary Mantel. Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast. Hilary Mantel may have had plenty of time to brace herself for success, as she quipped in The Guardian last year, but what a success it is. After 8 long years, Mantel is back with the final part of her Cromwell trilogy, The Mirror and the Light. Fans gave her the Harry Potter treatment, queuing at midnight to get hold of her latest 900-page literary blockbuster. So, Sian, what's it like?
Oh, it's really, really good. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sort of one of those people that has been waiting for 8 years between Bring Up the Bodies and this.
Only a couple.
Yeah, only a couple, basically. It was one of those books I really vividly remember when Wolf Hall came out, and I was working in a bookshop then, and we got an advanced reading copy of it, and I know the bookseller that still has the copy of that proof, like she holds onto it like such an achievement.
Precious.
I knew this was good before everyone else knew it was good. But then it sold huge amounts, and so I never really read it because it wasn't anything I ever really had to recommend to people. I sort of stuck to it.
Because they came in asking
for
it.
They just would want it, yeah. You know? And I always sort of viewed it as something kind of amazing and very daunting in that it was quite a hefty book, and I knew it was historical fiction, which I didn't really read much of at the time. And the fact that so many people came in for it, though, made me think, like, oh, this is quite strange. Like, this is almost what you would expect for a commercial novel, and this is very much not sort of a thriller, a commercial thriller or something. But it's so amazing now, having read the most of the third, that there's this really, you really notice that when you think back to, like, sort of great reading experiences that you've had, you can sort of lump them into different categories, and you can say, well, I really enjoyed this book because it is a compulsive read. And then I really enjoyed this book because of the skill that is shown in this book, because, you know, the writing is beautiful, and I enjoyed it simply for the quality and skill shown.
Yeah, the prose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when you get a book like this, where it's both at the same time, it's kind of amazing to have a reading experience when you're constantly aware while you're reading how much you're enjoying yourself.
Yeah, and not only that, but also you're part of this massive kind of phenomenon. There's people yes. all over the country having the same reading experience.
Yes, and I don't know what it was like for people. I guess it wouldn't have been the same for Wolf Hall, in that I think perhaps, you know, that was a bit, you know, there was some sort of word of mouth still happening amongst readers. And
then, it was slower to build, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and then Booker Prize win, and then the second book comes out. Maybe by the second book there was some sort of sense of phenomena, but then with an 8-year wait, it's kind of fantastic to have such a big book and an accomplished book, and also have a book that had huge expectations riding on it, and to have it meet those expectations and by doing so surpass them is kind of a really amazing thing. And yeah, having a book that you're reading and enjoying and being aware that you're enjoying it, I haven't had that for such a long time. And she, like, Mantel's so skilled in, and I think part of it perhaps is she has talked about this, her use of the present tense to insert some sort of sense of urgency into a story where we know where it's going. You know, there's no spoilers. We know that Thomas Cromwell is beheaded at the Tower of London, and we know we're getting there. But the fact that she can make it compulsive to return to and see how she's going to take you there is just like so incredible.
And it's cut from the same cloth. It's the same present tense narration. It's the same, very much being inside his head. It's
yes, exactly. And you are constantly, I think, like part of the joy of it is that we are aware of Cromwell as a historical figure and how he's taught in education and in schools, and you know what we can infer from his character, and you know he's the villain. But when you are inside his head, it's you absolutely understand his reasoning, and it does feel very unjust when he is finally arrested and put in isolation. And it's basically probably about the last 200 pages of this book is him answering to interrogators, and there's this beautiful sort of dialogue back and forth, like really witty and cutting, and lots of backstabbing happening between all these figures that have been popping up throughout all the books, who are now basically trying to get Cromwell out of the picture so they can sort of assume bits of his power. And
because there's a focus on his trial, such as it was, and his, it's, that's the balance of the book, is it?
Yeah, so it's set over the last 4 years of his life, and then there's this I think it's like 48 days he spent in the Tower of London, and it's just such beautiful writing, in that you are constantly reminded of moments from the previous books, moments in earlier in his life that we didn't know about, and I mean it's not a spoiler certainly, but just in terms of how she writes the final seconds of his life on the last couple of pages, there's a beautiful use of the very first scene from the first book that comes back, and that amazing first line, "So now get up," which was, I loved that when they announced this book, and there was that teaser billboard that was put in the middle of London, and everyone lost their mind because it said nothing, but it said "So now get up," and everyone immediately knew that we were going to find out when this book was coming out. And to see that line come back in the final moments inside his head, you know, it's a really emotional and affecting scene, even though you know this was a real man, and I feel the emotional attachment to him like I would like a best loved character, a fictional character. So yeah, it's a kind of a remarkable achievement, and we have been constantly taking photos of pages. This is what I do. Instead of underlining things in books, I take photos of pages so I can remember passages, and my phone is now filled of pictures of pages in this book. But just as an example, if you haven't read Mantel, just small moments like this. When he was an infant, his sister Cat used to tell him the bells made the time. When the hour strikes and the music shivers in the air, you have the best of it, and what's left is like the sucked plum stone on the side of a plate. Isn't that just beautiful?
Yes.
Like, oh, she's just so wonderful. And this is from a moment when he's Cromwell was in the Tower. He says, "July and the nights are short. When the light begins to fade, he sends the boy out again to find his supper, while he thinks of heaven and hell. When he pictures hell, he can only think of a cold place, a wasteland, a wharf, a marsh, a landing stage, water distantly boiling, and then the boiling coming nearer. This is how it will be, not pain itself, but the constant apprehension of pain, the constant apprehension of fault, the knowledge that you are going to be punished for something you couldn't help and didn't even know was wrong, and the discord in hell will be constant, repeating forever and ever, a violent argument being carried on in the next room. Isn't that beautiful?
And there's 900 pages of it. I mean, what's it like having that kind of experience at that kind of scale?
Well, do you know what? Like yesterday, I went and bought my book. This is how much I love it. I get sent free books all the time, and I went and bought a book. I went into the shop and picked it up and realized I haven't held a book that big. And this is even including Duck's New Report, which was a paperback, and so it was kind of a bit more flexible. But I haven't held a book that big since, I think, the fifth Harry Potter book, and it is actually kind of comparable.
It's that chunky.
It's that chunky. Mm. I do understand, like, I'm not wedded to e-readers or anything like that, or print books either. I'm unromantic about these things. It's more about convenience. But actually, the physical book is a very beautiful thing, and I'm quite glad that I have it. And yeah, you do need to break the spine.
So do you think there's any kind of route, any kind of opening, any possibility of another one, a sequel?
No, this is it. And she has actually said that some people have asked her to write about Elizabeth, sort of last of everything. But she is like, no, not interested.
Done. Finished. Yeah, she's arrived at the point where she set off from, and that's it.
And I think, like, she came into Walpole and all of these books because she was interested in Cromwell as the man rather than the period or, you know, the setting. She wanted to write about Cromwell, and she initially pictured it as one book, and then now it's become three massive books. I think, like, that's actually a very good thing that's her judgment, is that, you know, when you have such a masterful portrait of a man's character like this, you kind of go, okay, well, if you don't find Elizabeth interesting, then, you know, let's wait and to see who
something
you
else
find interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And so I guess the 50,000 pound question is, will it win the Booker Prize?
Oh, it's got to. And I kind of feel bad for everyone that's longlisted for the Booker this year, because they're just going to be like, oh great, I'm up against that. I mean, it will be a real shock if it doesn't.
That's it, she's got it in the bag.
Yeah, I mean, you know, three for three, you know.
Unprecedented.
Yeah.
And that's all for this week, with that triumph to come. Next week, we'll be returning to the 16th century with Toby Ferris, who'll tell us about his pursuit of the Dutch master, Peter Bruegel. We'd love to hear your thoughts about fantastical London or Thomas Cromwell on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the podcast page. And you can always subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, from me, Richard Lee.
Me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Esther Opoku-Jenny. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.